As an added benefit to reoccurring donors, we are sending out DCO face masks to any monthly contributors for 3 months or more at the $5 plus level. Please send your size preference, either large or youth or small size, along with membership email and mailing address to info@dcontario.org. And you can check out what they look like in the show notes. This podcast was specifically created for Distress and Crisis Ontario organizations and their volunteer responders to provide training and educational assistance on a variety of topics. As information evolves and changes, these podcasts are meant to offer ongoing support with the goal of updating them on an ongoing basis. We thank the volunteer responders and the contributors to this podcast. Please visit our website, dcontario.org, for more information and how to access free mental health services. Thank you.
Hello, this is Caitlin Plant, Program Manager for Distress and Crisis Ontario, and this week we continue to explore the topics of resiliency and recovery through the story of Jazzy and her insights into the incredible life she has lived. Jazzy's granddaughter, Hannah, was kind enough to sit down with her grand to record this podcast for us, and it led to a wonderful conversation that we are grateful to be able to share with you. It's a bit of a longer podcast than we usually release, but I assure you that it's worth it. A small disclaimer, Jazzy uses some language that may seem offensive to some. However, it is relevant to the context of the conversation and times being discussed and is not meant to be disrespectful or derogatory. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy it.
Hannah, I'm a friend of Distress and Crisis Ontario, and this morning for DCO's podcast series on resilience and recovery, I have the privilege of interviewing my Grant. Grant, I know all about you, but a lot of our listeners don't know who you are, so maybe you could start by just sharing a brief summary of yourself and the life you've lived.
Well, my next birthday is 84. The richest things in my life at this very moment are my three daughters and my six grandchildren and my three sons-in-law. That's more than money in the bank. It keeps me resilient. Their unconditional love and caring and availability is the essence of resilience. Who cares about you matters. And it literally keeps me alive. I've been in Canada for my youngest child, Hannah's mom, Sunita, is going to be 56. And she's been in Canada since she was 15 months old. That makes me Canadian, well, landed immigrant and Canadian, for 55 years. So I am older than half the Canadian population.
That's true. So maybe you could talk a bit about where you grew up, just so people know kind of where you're coming from.
I was born in a rural part of Guyana. And Guyana is on the eastern seaboard of South America. And how do Indians, South Asians, now the official word for my ethnic group is South Asian. So how did South Asians get to be on this northeast coast of South America is at least a 2-hour lecture on colonial oppression. So I'll just leave you with where I was born in rural Guyana on the Essequibo coast is to my parents, who themselves were children of the semi-slave group from India, recruited and shipped away by the British Raj from 1838 to 1911. That's my ancestral history. And where I was born in rural Guyana, we were separated from the city, from the county, three counties in Guyana. Mine was Essequibo. The middle county was Demerara, which had the capital city of Georgetown. And the third county was Berbice. But my part of rural Guyana was separated by the enormous, amazing, mythical river called the Essequibo River. And people were afraid of it, so people hardly ever crossed it. So my part of rural Guyana was settled by Indians and by black people who came earlier as slaves. And the Indians call Indo-Guyanese and the black people call Afro-Guyanese made a life together throughout mm-hmm. Guyana.
I know whenever I've listened to your story growing up, I marvel at the resilience of your mom and of your family, just how when they first got there, they were these indentured laborers, but then your mom became this manager of the plantation where you lived. Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
I have reflected for a long time on the resilience of both my parents, but my mother particularly. My mother was orphaned at 11 years old through the Spanish flu of 1918-17, 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Both her parents and her brother, a year older than her, died on the sea. He died the day before his parents, and both mom and dad died on the same day of the flu in their ancestral village of Richmond, Essequibo, Guyana. And my mother lived her life before marriage, after the death of her parents, and during her years before marriage and all through her life in the midst of what we call the extended family. Mm-hmm. But that she had to survive with her married sisters and brothers whose children were her age. I've often wondered how she must have missed her own mother. She was only mothered up to age 11. But I think what sustained my mother through her life were the narratives and stories she grew up with about these relatives. I call them a basketful of relatives. Her siblings were 9 and they had umpteen children, and neighbors became aunties and up. And she was nurtured by this clan and the clan. She nurtured the clan and the clan nurtured her. Actually, the clan helped her survive. Mm-hmm. So she showed a resilience. When I was studying to be a social worker, I was asked by a panel. I was on a panel of what led me to social work. And I said, unconsciously, maybe, because I wasn't conscious, I never knew I'd be educated, is that my mother carried the soul of her clan mm-hmm. in her love, trust, and total dedication to her clan was like clinical social work.
Yeah.
And her sister, who had no patience with individuals, became a master suffragette in Guyana for Indian women and education. Those were my mm-hmm. two role models.
Yeah, I know we've talked before about how your mom's model of supporting a community, that really influenced you when you came to Canada. And
absolutely.
Building your career as a social worker and trying to build community connections between other people.
Right. There was a message, and I didn't know I was absorbing it. It was, there is always someone to help.
Yeah.
So that never failed me up to now at 80-something years old, that there's always someone to help. I could go out to my driveway and stop somebody with my hand who I know will help.
That's an important lesson, I think, for a lot of people.
And it's helped me in social work by teaching that.
Absolutely. So through all these, like through your childhood and then meeting my grandfather and then moving to Canada with these 3 young children and building your career as a social worker, was there ever a time during all this when you thought you wouldn't be able to make it through something you were struggling against? And if you felt this way, what helped you overcome that?
I think my marriage to your grandfather were 2 adolescents facing desperate circumstances in their life. Mm-hmm. I think there was no Harlequin romance that they saw in each other's eyes and they fell blindly in love. We married to survive, and
right.
we did.
Yeah.
But what happened when the very first time I thought, what's ever going to happen here, is the day we lived through the crisis in a part of Guyana where there were ethnic riots.
Right.
This was
in Wisma, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It was called the Wisma Troubles, and we had to be evacuated as a family with 2 babies. And the company, your granddad worked for, an insurance company, shipped us off to St. Lucia to find work for him because we were displaced as refugees in our own country.
Right. So you had to move to St. Lucia because it was so dangerous in Guyana?
Okay. And the company...
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, the company then created a position for him in St. Lucia. But there was this lived experience of someone to help. The riots in Wismar were between Blacks and Indians. Mm-hmm. Wherever there was a majority of one ethnic group, they slaughtered a minority group. So mm-hmm. in Wismar was the Black people in majority wiping out the minority of Indians. And would we even survive? The first crisis with mm-hmm. my young family or granddad was a lady of the opposite group, a Black lady, telling me she is going to hold my hand with my two babies and cross a mob of people to get on the ferry boat wow. out of Wismar.
Yeah.
Your granddad nearly lost his mind. How are you going to trust the enemy?
Oh God.
That lady could feed you to the mob. And I said, this lady won't do that. Where did that faith come from?
Yeah, how did you just trust someone like that?
I just trusted her. Yeah. I thought, there's no way she is going to betray me with my two babies. Mm-hmm. And the belief in the other, that's been my philosophy of life. Otherness has been my ally for life. Mm. Who is the other going to make this possible? Of course, she guided us. We left. So that was faith against reason
right.
that particular day. Then we got to St. Lucia, and we can't stay there because we are aliens. My brother in Canada says I could. The law in Canada had just changed
mm-hmm.
under the Diefenbaker regime.
Right, because prior to the law changing, Canada, brown people weren't allowed.
Right,
to
Canada, come to Canada was literally. I read the document as a whites-only country.
Absolutely, yeah.
So my brother's a student and says I could sponsor you to Canada.
What year was this? This was 1966.
The year Davika was born was the first time after okay. the riots, and then I said I'm not going because I'm expecting my second child. Not going to a foreign country because what will I do with my oldest child?
Yeah.
And then mm-hmm. when your mom was born, we were in St. Lucia. She's mm-hmm. born there.
In 65?
65. Mm-hmm. Then my brother wrote again and said, right. I could sponsor you to Canada. The day we were to leave, your granddad got a call from his head office to say, don't go. And all our friends, the house is empty, and all our friends and colleagues said, don't miss this opportunity.
Yeah.
And what that did is put the marriage into crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Because he came to Canada as a rebelling against. And then when we faced all the crises of no immigrants, no country and no customs and all that stuff, he went into a despair. And I thought that was the end of everything.
Mm-hmm.
My doctor asked me at the time, I had three little kids, if I had suicidal ideation. I learned that from the doctor, never heard the term before. And I said, no, but I met a neighbor. Here is the thing again of otherness.
Yeah.
Who befriended me. And how that happened was my brother, who sponsored us, was living in Guelph. And he said, it's no trouble. If your husband's job is waiting for him, just go back and get
go back to St. Lucia.
But when he offered to do that, his job, his position was no longer available. So then he went further into crisis. And the marriage was fragile as it is. And I think that wedge of his wife, me, causing him to lose an idea he had, marked the marriage. It became cruel, it became stuff. But then a 5-year-old little boy that my 5-year-old daughter went to school with, I registered, and this little boy called Jimmy lived in the apartment, and he came one day with a little girl, and they came to call on this friendly words children use,
mm-hmm.
Can I call on her? And she told them, my name is Davika. She made everybody spell her name. She was 5 years old and told everybody to spell her name. She wasn't going to be called Debbie or any derivative of D. So the little guy walked with her to school. I never saw an elevator in my life, never trusted it. I thought, what if it shoots through the whole thing? But that little boy brought his mother to see me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, she said, Jimmy came to call on you. Well, anyway, that lady became a significant other. She showed me, she said, people are not going to accept your color as a babysitter. And I said, I can't go out to work because I have three little kids. And she said, well, then you could take care of kids at home. And I said, how do I do that? And she, this is the question that I ask even today. People say to do something and I say, how do I do that?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It has saved my life many times.
Absolutely.
That's positive. It is a thing, a demonstration of resilience that she's going to tell me how. And she said, I will be your reference because people may not accept you as a darky.
Oh my goodness.
And
Lord.
and she's a white lady, but she knew her country. And
I've always been so amazed by like all the people, just strangers that helped you guys when you got to Canada, especially because there weren't a lot of immigrants here. They just kind of looked at you guys and said, yeah, I can help you.
Well, that's the story of my, whether they were racist or not, they didn't stop to check it out. She said, I will write the ad. I'll be a reference.
Yeah.
So when people came to leave their kids with me, she said, ask them to come at a time when I could be. Out of the blue, she became the reference, and she's a white lady. And years later, that's how I know white privilege works. That she would
That's very true.
That's white privilege in action. Anyway, I became a babysitter. So we got along as well we could. So what was the next big crisis is always worry over money and survival. But what kept this couple together with their kids was this extent. My brother was in Guelph. My cousin was in Toronto.
You had a network of people supporting you.
And they were exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that really helped through all the crises, you know. So my being in Canada, my life in Wismar, I charted my course without relatives. St. Lucia was the same. They were all strangers and they all embraced us.
Yeah, you always found people to help, even if they were strangers or relatives,
absolutely,
co-workers.
Absolutely. Yeah. Same. And I think it has to do, I think I'm a beacon for approachability.
I think so too. Sometimes like we'll go to the grocery store. Our listeners probably don't know this, and I can't go anywhere with you in this community without running into someone you know.
Well, I think that essence of approachability, and I'd have a wonderful colleague in social work. We went to a conference together, and she's African American, came here to and became a Canadian citizen. And we would go places and she would say, look, people will approach you, but they won't approach her. And I said, why don't you approach them? And she said, why should I? So we had this thing about, is there something called approachability? And now I know it does exist. How come it doesn't threaten me to approach somebody?
Right.
And if it doesn't work, I say I haven't lost anything.
Yeah. So your resilience was kind of bolstered by you being this approachable person that could build these relationships with people.
And the relationships worked out. Somebody was.
Yeah.
And they were. So this, the validation that the thing works has fueled my life, my faith life.
Yeah.
It works. And people say just all kinds of things. So there were two later crises that I thought I would not survive. And that's when I decided to run away from your grandfather. By then I knew the word abusive. By then I knew there is no reciprocity. There is an element of cruelty. By now I was learning that cruelty kills. And so I planned an escape with strangers.
Yeah.
I asked three, and when he decided to be what the textbooks called the tyrant will not accept somebody run away from him, did everything he could to destabilize me economically and did.
Yeah.
So through that breakup and a lawyer as dreadful as him, I lost everything and I literally didn't think I could overcome that. I thought, oh my God, depression, not seeing clearly, and again, all these amazing people.
Yeah, I think like when I think about your career, that was like the height of your career.
Right? My career, I had become a social worker.
You were, what year was this? 89?
I was in my 40s. 40s. I ran away in 85. I was in graduate school. The saddest thing about that was your mom, Sunita, was also going to university. And both her parents in crisis, and neither was able to support that young girl. That has haunted me all my whole life.
Yeah.
That she's cast out. And her resilience.
Absolutely.
Of not giving up university, going to Toronto, doesn't know where she will live, doesn't know this, that, and the other, and pursuing it. A friend of mine gave her a tiny bit of support, but not enough to help her survive those 4 years. But then how did that resolve itself? It's a lady entered my life. I say that because she was a friend of a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a part-time job at the Y while studying for my Master of Social Work. And that paid for my fees. And that same lady loaned me money to get an apartment. And that eased up. She said, you're going to make it through this. Keep up with your studies. And
I wonder, like, when you were going through this period of divorce and family crisis, like, what you found your greatest supports were to get you through that period?
I told one of my professors that I had no money for textbooks. And he said, here's one gift. This is a key to my own library.
Mm-hmm.
You could use my key to borrow any book. This guy only knows me as a part-time student.
Mm-hmm.
Borrow anything, just leave me a little note what you do. That's how I studied to be a social worker without ever buying a textbook. So that was one thing. This guy thinks I could continue studying. The other was a classmate who was mature like me, and I had to miss classes to go to court to see if I could get support. And this lovely lady, I told her, I'm only going to tell you I have to go to court. And she, I told her why. And she said, I'll take all your notes for you. And if you like, I'll write your papers. And I thought,
oh my goodness.
You're going to write a paper for me?
What a lady.
What a lady. She said, don't worry about it. You're doing bigger things in your life here. So I got through that. I found the job. And then this amazing job started out. And the divorce is just done. I've got a degree. I've got some work experience. I'm a community volunteer all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Founding member with my friend Ari for Focus for Ethnic Women, which was a group in town. And then I got the nerve to interview for a job for a newly provincial funded program called Better Beginnings, Better Futures. I knew all about it. My work in Waterloo exposed me to it. And I applied for this job. And in a little room in a public housing, there were 8 people to interview me. 3 managers of agencies and 4 parents.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents, I thought, if parents are interviewing me, I could really listen to their concerns. And I handled the interview, and I didn't hear, and I thought they were too scared to hire. I wasn't from Guelph. And then I got a call from a mother who said, we have hired you for this position of Better Beginning.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, they were such amazing questions. There was a guy in the room, and he said, if we hire you, will you get more people of your kind to come?
What do you mean?
and the agency people were freaking out because you don't ask people that. But I thought I'd answer him. I said, do you mean people who are immigrants to Canada, people who look like me? Is that what you mean? He said, yes, we need them. We need them, people like you. And I said, you know, it will depend on my knowledge, my skill, my experience, and your willingness to be inclusive.
What year was this when you started Better Beginnings?
I started Better Beginnings in 1991.
And it grew so much after that. It became this incredible community organization.
Absolutely. It was one of it. Well, the government funded it for 3 things. Kids, at-risk kids, their parents, and their community, and I was qualified in all 3.
I wonder, like, as a social worker, working with all these different populations, if you've seen people that have shown resilience, how have they kind of generated that resilience? What's helped them be resilient, the people you've worked with?
Well, I would say every person involved in Better Beginnings, in the Guelph Better Beginnings, was what the research calls disadvantaged, at risk, poor, below the poverty line. That's the research. And these people had faces. They were names and stuff. And I use my Guyana lived experience to, first of all, respect all these people, regardless what they knew, that they were the legitimate owners of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And that was revolutionary to my social work colleagues who saw them as the problem, right? Social workers tend to see poor people as a problem rather than how did we, I always want to say to friends, why don't we trace how we made them poor? Poverty is a social structure.
Absolutely.
It's a structure. We create it and then we park people in public housing and leave them to their own devices. Imagine if we lived next door to people we didn't know whose lifestyles varied from what we had. We would quarrel just. And why do we think we're so darn special?
It's true.
So anyway, what happened by giving people who felt socially fragile opportunities for expressing their thoughts, for creating positions for leadership, for validating their wisdom, created a whole group of positive energy for those same people. One lady said, I don't know why they call me poor. Because poor people don't call themselves poor, you just don't have enough to eat.
Yeah.
Why would you go around saying, I don't have enough groceries, so I'm poor? I mean, it's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Who would ever do that? So women took opportunities to go back to school. Some went to counseling for abuse. Leadership, oh my God, blossomed. Opportunities to lead and speak. I created a public speaking forum. There's one of these women working now at the Distress Center as secretary. I hope she's still there. If her name is Jackie, then she's one of these people from Willow, the creative group of. And accepting when people talk about their own fears and limitations, instead of sending them for counseling, you give them support. So if you're afraid of public speaking and you're using your voice is to publicly tell the world who you are, then you'll take two friends with you, one on either side, and they will buffet you. The other time Better Beginnings helped me see that the divorce that took away everything did not take away my job. That was the most amazing thing in my whole life. Oh my God, now I could go back to being a daycare teacher, $12 an hour, but I didn't think that social work would be my career.
So your career kind of gave you, it built your identity in a different way, like outside of your marriage.
With credibility.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. That the role had built into it, it was not risk-free because the way I saw social work as a community organizer is the opposite to how my clinical friends were seeing social work, which was not a defined problem.
Well, clinical social work, it's like it's between two people, whereas we were just talking the other day about how in community social work, you kind of bring a completely different framework to it because it's about the whole community and to build someone's resilience.
And that was it.
Yeah.
So my colleagues in social, especially in senior management in Guelph, really was it. There was a mutual respect.
Right.
That I would bring my perspective, my lens, community lens, and not the problem lens. So I wasn't going to concentrate on anybody's problem because they all had, it was the norm. That was the norm. So how were they going to break their own cycle through resources, personal resources, opportunities, respect for their situation, speaking up for them when other people were cutting them up? And an active component of community organizing is adult education.
Mm-hmm.
How do you start working with adults? The first thing is adults are not children. They're not empty slates. They have lived experience.
Yeah.
So then I checked in on experience and found out, I call the resources of what the literature was calling capacity. I called it Willow's capacity of strengths.
Did you see a difference in how the resilience in adults versus the resilience in children? Because I know you've worked with both.
The resilience in children really depends on opportunity.
Right.
The first thing we tried out is in poor neighborhoods, there is no access to free recreation. Yeah. I contrasted it after my trip to India, and I looked at every Indian community. The green space belonged to the city.
Yeah, I read about that.
The cricket, any little kid with a stick. In Canada, recreation belongs to those who could pay. Mm-hmm. And it is a crime against poor children.
Yeah.
So how to change that? I built an alliance with public housing that had money to give, stringently give kids who lived in public housing a grant, and only the poor kids could go. And then I thought, I'm going to try something out here. Could they pay for the poor kids? Could other grants pay for all the kids? And could I run an inclusive summer playground? Mm-hmm. The city of Guelph was dubious because you got to go through training. And these kids would never be accepted in city training,
yeah,
because their behavior needs improvement. Mm-hmm. So I thought, there was a beautiful youth worker, and she said, oh, these kids are impossible. And I said, here's a remedy. You recruit older high school and whoever, adults, and there's 5 kids who misbehave with an adult in front and behind them to stop the bad behavior. You can't hit anybody. You can't leave the line and go somewhere and shed a whistle. Within one summer, those kids wanted to play so badly that they stopped the bad behavior. They want, because children want to participate. Yeah. Maybe one who is mentally troubled will do stuff. And at that point, the rule in municipal recreation is, you mess up, you get expelled. You don't get to. And I thought, how are you going to expel Johnny in his own neighborhood? It's absurd. He lives next door. He's going to go there and disrupt the whole program.
Yeah, and then the cycle kind of starts for the poor kids.
So he has to be made to stay in this program,
right,
with a one-on-one support. Well, the staff said, you know, we solved the problem. You go find a one-on-one support and pay him. Mm-hmm. So the kids and you know what the kids did? Because it was not culturally inclusive when I got there. Even though Afghans had moved into the neighborhood, Southeast Asians, called boat people, were there. But those little children embraced, I called them the rainbow of Willow's children. Those little kids embraced each other. They didn't see slant eyes. Mm-hmm. They didn't see blackie. They didn't see what they call the little Indian children, Pakis. They didn't see any of that.
Yeah.
They just, and then the teacher, wonderful, wonderful teachers, taught the kids how to pronounce names, how to say people's names. And so kids respond, if we only knew that all those youth in crisis, there's research I read that if they had recreational inclusion before age 12, it would have paid off.
Yeah, because I think when you build those things early, you can build your resilience for later on as an adult. Because sometimes adults are set back if they haven't had those experiences.
Exactly.
At a young
and
age.
And inclusion. There was and Bob Rae was, for a short time, Premier of Ontario. He had a study on health. And there was a wonderful book written by a guy called Dan Offord, who looked at the role recreation plays in the life of youth. And I thought bureaucrats could change situations.
We should probably wrap things up in a few minutes, but I'm wondering, just like to kind of round things out, if there's one piece of advice or life lesson that you found yourself coming back to or giving other people about resilience and how to build resilience in yourself.
I think it's the real belief that you're not alone.
Yeah.
That trouble has companions in any sphere. Mm-hmm. And that supporting someone who doesn't quite believe that, how do you become a connector to that? That's another social work, lived experience, connections work.
Yeah.
And how to say to people, there's always help. We need to find out where you could find some help so that you give. I think hope is an active ingredient in resilience.
Wow.
It's active. Yeah. It's like yeast in my raisin bread. That's what hope is. It multiplies itself the more you give it away. And I never lose hope. I despair. I have health troubles and I think the worst. And I have these amazing 3 daughters. Each of them's worldview comes together. They're not always. But each of them will give me some sense of personal empowerment again. And your mom is really good at that. It's either mm-hmm. is that I could do this or you could do this or let's do this together. And she's coming to me to a pacemaker clinic. And she has no idea how helpful it is because I lose track of what the technician is saying.
Yeah.
I'm so busy trying to understand him until she would clarify something.
Yeah, or write notes. I know she takes copious notes.
And then the notes educate me.
Mm-hmm.
So hope is an active ingredient. My lived I'm too old to change my mind. That's another thing. I'm not going to give up on the values. And that thing, I could demonstrate how things have helped me to get to be where I am. It's not in a book. I've lived it. The mm-hmm. people are there to validate. Yeah, if all the health holds, maybe I'll see next birthday. I always tell you and my grandkids,
oh, no.
If I know my name and I know my address, I'm doing good.
I think you're doing great. I think you're 84 years old. Your health is in such good shape and your mind is still so sharp, which is a testament to your ability to recover and be resilient.
Well, I think the resilience must come off the semi-slave boat of my grandfather.
I think so, too. Your roots have a lot to do with it.
How did he survive the journey?
Yeah.
If you look at where the eastern seaboard of India is, and you look at where Guyana is, mm-hmm. you're going to cross oceans and continents. And how did he survive eating dal and rice twice a day?
It's amazing.
And so both grandfathers survived the journey, what my friend at York calls it, the crossing the Kalapani, it's crossing the black water. There's a book written about
the trip across the ocean from
India.
Yeah.
Eastern seaboard, some were from Uttar Pradesh, and some when the boat had space picked up the other ancestors from Chennai, which was called Madras.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that little man get off the boat with that little bundle on his back
mm-hmm.
and created a clan in Guyana, which include my mom, his youngest daughter.
Yeah.
So something in him must have come down.
Yeah, I think, you know, the way you build communities and the way your mom did, maybe that's something that my great-great-grandfather must have done when he first got to Guyana.
And I think his wife, who my grandmother Ramdee, who was born in Guyana, there was something my mom learned from her, is that, and there's a saying in Guyana, you cannot go to a house with empty hands.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom learned from her mother, she was 11 when she was orphaned, you carry something. Do not go with empty hands. My mom practiced that. I grew up with every visit my mother would make to her clan, some who were badly off poverty-wise and some who were some of Guyana's most well-to-do people. Mm-hmm. We Narayan children straddled that social class continuum for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
We'd visit my father's sister who wore no shoes. Her feet were deformed, and my aunt, who wore her hat and glove like the Queen Mother, to go to the races.
Yeah.
In one summer, I would live that social continuum with absolute respect for both contingents.
Yeah.
So that was ingrained, and I think all my siblings have that, this stuff. And we carried bananas or breadfruit mm-hmm. or...
It's something you taught my mom, too. She's always taught me to never go to someone else's house empty-handed.
Well, Canadians have a similar thing. I learned here that if you're invited to dinner, you take something. In Guyana, food was reciprocal.
Right.
The food you would take would be more gift-like than contributing to the meal. But I learned that here, and I learned that this collective way of feeding people called a potluck. I thought, oh my God, how does a pot have luck? What is luck of a pot? And then you go and you see that everybody brings food and everybody shares food.
It's beautiful. Well, I really appreciated talking with you about communities and resilience. It was a really enlightening chat. I learned some things I didn't know.
I think you have resilience, honey.
I'd like to think so, too.
Moving to that big city of Toronto and not turning around and hiding at home.
Yeah, I definitely did. I relied on communities just like you talked about. And it was hard in the last year because with so much isolation, it felt like those communities weren't there as much as they used to be.
Yeah.
But hopefully as the pandemic dies down, people will start to go back to building communities. And
I hope so.
Helping each other. Me too.
Yeah. So there.
Thanks, Gran.
Hi, I'm Damien, one of the editors of the DCO Learning Forums podcast. We are committed to providing the most current and up-to-date information. With your help, we can make it better. Please consider going to tips.pinecast.com/jar/distress-and-crisis-ontario.com or by clicking the link in the show notes. And by donating, monthly contributors will be able to access a special podcast feed. In it, we'll have additional content and some more in-depth pieces on some of our most popular topics. Thank you.